Moving on to item four, which is our featured item of the day. We have some fiduciary duty education going to be presented by our fiduciary counsel from Nossaman. Good morning. Podium.
Good morning.
Table, whatever.
Podium works for me if it works for all of you. Is that all right?
You should be as comfortable as you want to be.
Thank you. Well, good morning, members of the board. I'm Ashley Dunning from Nossaman. Delighted to be here in the new year with all of you and hope you had a lovely new year. We're providing fiduciary education today. I was here 2 years ago, almost to the month. And so I'll be discussing a little bit of what I discussed then and then approaching the presentation with a few additional angles that I hope livens it for you, provides an opportunity for you to ask questions, for us to engage in dialogue if you desire. So with no further ado, we could advance the slides, please, whoever's doing that.
You can use the clicker.
Oh, which is in my hand. And glasses on my head? No. Thank you. All right, so that's me. All right, so as I said, we're going to recap the presentation I gave a couple of years ago, and then the education for today will focus on these discrete topics. We're going to talk about the differences between roles of an entity that performs a settlor function, a trustor function, that's kind of a fancy word for the one who creates the trust, and the fiduciary function, which is the role that you're all in here. And then I have a whole series of slides with do's and don'ts. So different topics that may come up in the course of your engagement on the board and ways in which a good fiduciary would proceed and ways in which we think are less compliant with fiduciary responsibilities. And then finally, we will dive a little deeper into what we call the single hat rule, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. All right, so here's the recap. First of all, definitionally, we talked about what a fiduciary is. And we drew from the Restatement Third of Trust, which is how California courts have analyzed fiduciary obligations of trustees on public retirement boards in California. And the key concept here is that when you're exercising discretion over the administration of a plan and investment of its assets, you are dealing with other people's money, and you have a fiduciary obligation, that, therefore, to act with the highest level of prudence and loyalty. And then I broke it down to the elements that are set forth in the bullet points on this slide. So first of all focusing on board members as well as your executive officers, you are fiduciaries in this role, definitionally, who therefore owe these two primary duties, the duties of care and loyalty, to whom? To Cicera members and their qualified beneficiaries. So it's not that you owe fiduciary responsibilities to everybody in the world now. You only owe them to your members and their qualified beneficiaries. But do you owe them those duties with respect to everything in their lives? Of course not. What you owe those duties with respect to is the Cicera benefits that are due to them by Cicera. And then we discussed these duties and we considered various hypotheticals. I mentioned the two prongs of fiduciary responsibility because those are the way in which fiduciary law describes the primary duties of trustees. In California, for public retirement system trustees, there are some specific fiduciary obligations that you have as articulated both in the California Constitution and in the County Employees Retirement Law of 1937 for purposes of Cicera that I've delineated further here because they're really important to understanding how your fiduciary responsibilities play out in the context of the administration of a defined benefit, multi-billion dollar defined benefit plan such as Cicera's. The first two are the ones that are the sort of the primary focuses for trustees, duty of loyalty. And here the way we articulate that duty is that you have a duty to act in the overall best interest of CICERA members and beneficiaries with respect to the CICERA benefits that are owed to them. So there are a lot of components to that that we walked through a bit the last time I went through this, which is overall best interest of CICERA members and beneficiaries doesn't mean that every member or beneficiary is going to be pleased with the decisions that you make, or that the decisions that you make will be financially advantageous to them. You're making a decision that's in the overall best interest of the members and beneficiaries, and that's because you're applying the plan consistent with its terms. You're giving them the benefits, or you're providing the benefits timely to them that the plan authorizes, and not providing those that are not authorized. Think of a disability retirement context, for example, where somebody may apply for a disability retirement. They think they're entitled to it. You make an independent determination that they're not going to be happy with you, but you're acting in the overall best interest of your members and beneficiaries, consistent with your duty of loyalty by not granting that benefit. Duty of care. The key here is that you all come to this board with different levels of expertise and experience based on your own life experience. You are lay people definitionally, and yet by law you are deemed not to be a lay person in this role. You are deemed to be one who has to act as a prudent fiduciary with experience in a similar enterprise, which is why you need to, number one, educate yourself on the topics that are important to the prudent administration of plans such as CICERA. You need to rely upon and engage with experts, both in-house and outside where appropriate, on the key topics. And that's how you comply with this responsibility to act as somebody who has experience in these areas. Feel free to ask questions or provide comments as we go through this. I'm speaking quickly here, but I welcome, through the chair, any comments. Third one here, and this is particular to, as I mentioned, a multi-billion dollar fund where you actually have the investment authorization. Not all public plans in the country, or even in the states, retirement boards administer the investments of the plan, but you do. So in the context of your investment authority, you have a duty to diversify the investments of the plan in order to maximize risk-adjusted return. And that's looked at from a total portfolio perspective. The fourth bullet point here, again, is particular to a California public retirement system that is a defined benefit plan. And that is your duty to assure the competency of the retirement system assets to pay promised benefits. What does that mean? That means that you are administering the plan, in a way that is reasonably anticipated to have sufficient assets to timely pay benefits when they're due. So people are, or your active members are earning benefits during their employment. They're putting contributions into the plan. The employers are putting contributions in plan. You're investing those assets prudently. You're doing all of this in the context of annual actuarial valuations and triannual experience studies, where you're regularly reassessing whether your demographic assumptions are reasonable, whether your economic assumptions are reasonable. And in that manner, you put together a plan that complies with this responsibility. Fifth bullet point, the duty to defray the reasonable administrative expenses needed to accomplish the necessary work of the board. Cost-conscious management of the retirement system is fundamental to prudence, and courts have said that all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And then finally, the duty to administer the plan in accordance with plan terms and other applicable law. That's key as well. You are a statutory plan. You are defined by and limited by the terms of the plan, and that's what you're to provide, nothing more, nothing less.
I have a question for you.
Of course.
Just, and you may have answered this previously, but are there any examples, at least recent examples, of legal cases involving a challenge to a trustee or an agency board based on an allegation of abuse of discretion or failure to, follow the standard required to exercise your fiduciary duty?
There are plenty of those. Yeah, so there are cases pending in court right now, and there are cases that have been decided where where there have been allegations either by members or by employers or by others, taxpayer groups, that boards have not complied with their fiduciary responsibilities. One of the cases that I believe I discussed in the last presentation, and I think it might be cited here, is the involving a Searle system, was the O'Neill versus Stansera case. And that was a case where following the Great Recession in 2008, 2009, that board had made some decisions about how to handle their reserves. They had some, they had a large reserve that was not counted for valuation purposes, and they transferred some of it into county advance reserves. And they also expanded their amortization period for unfunded liability repayment and a few other actions. And a retiree group claimed that the actions that the board had taken were in violation of their fiduciary responsibilities. And that case was litigated for many, many years. The board ended up prevailing, but it was after having gone up to the Court of Appeal two times. So there are lots of examples of that.
Yeah, I just, we've had, I guess, in the past, just thinking back to the time that I've been on the board, some tumult from time to time about either, you know, and I'm thinking largely of the 2012-13 time period when you know, the law changed, and there was a lot of consternation, a lot of very, very legitimate concern on all sides. And there was lots of angst, there was lots of emotion, but at least locally, we didn't have any litigation other than the challenges to the act and whatnot. But in terms of challenges to individual trustees or trustees' boards, I'm not aware of any that were lodged, at least locally, against boards, right, for abusing their, you know, responsibility, for failing to adhere to their fiduciary obligation. I can't think of one anyway, locally.
Well, there was another one that was lodged against your sister system, Alameda County Employers Retirement Association, relating to the manner in which it calculates employer contributions due to the retirement system. And that was against the retirement system and the board. And again, the retirement system prevailed there, but it was an allegation of breach of fiduciary responsibility. It was a petition for a writ, but it had built within it allegations of breach of fiduciary responsibility. And there are lots of tentacles to that that I won't get into here, but because you don't owe a fiduciary obligation to your employers. But there were a couple of members who also were suing in that context, too.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Typically, when individual trustees are named, those cases are, I have my litigator hat on now, but those cases are usually ones where one's able to get the individual trustee's name stricken, because you shouldn't have individual liability for acting within the course and scope of your responsibilities. The exception to that is if there is something untoward about what a particular trustee has done, and most often that or is alleged to have done, most often that has to do with alleged personal financial interests in a matter. So if there's a conflict of interest. And the most well-known example of that in California was the Lexan litigation. Now, that wasn't a breach of fiduciary duty case. That was a Government Code Section 1090 case involving allegations of financial conflict of interest in the way the system was funded, and then also the benefits that were being provided by the employer. The system and the trustees also prevailed, with the exception of one trustee in that case.
I have a question also. I was just thinking, why don't we owe fiduciary duty to employers? Because if we are reckless with the fund, then employers are the ones who will have to cover the shortfall.
That's a great question, and I will be talking about it a little bit more in terms of the context of the settler fiduciary distinction. But the reason to answer your question right now is that the way the relationship works is the settlor or the trustor, the county in this case, who's your plan sponsor, and to some degree, the governing bodies of your districts to the extent that they grant other different benefits, design the plan. You are the administrator of that plan. So you have to administer the plan consistent with the terms that have been adopted by the legislature and then through the Board of Supervisors or the governing boards of the districts. You have fiduciary responsibilities to do so to the benefit of the members and beneficiaries. So that fiduciary responsibility of care and loyalty applies to those to whom you owe that duty, which is the members and beneficiaries. That doesn't mean that you don't owe any duties to the employer. You have a duty of reasonableness, certainly. You can't be arbitrary or capricious in the way that you administer the plan. That's the California sort of general principle of quasi-legislative activity, is that's the standard. You can't be arbitrary or capricious. So it doesn't mean that the employer couldn't challenge you for being arbitrary or capricious, but in our judgment, based on applicable law, there's no basis for a fiduciary breach claim. Mm-hmm. Does that answer your question? It's a little bit wonky, but I think it's really important. Okay. So who are fiduciaries? The board, collectively, and its committees with respect to your responsibility to administer the retirement system in the overall best interest of members and beneficiaries. Individual members of the board, in-house investment and benefits staff who have discretionary authority or control over the investment of assets and administration of the plan with respect to those responsibilities. So if you'll notice, each context that we're talking about here involves the exercise of discretion and responsibility over some aspect of the administration of the plan or the investment of those assets. And in that role, each of the ones who has those roles has a fiduciary responsibility. And those who work outside the plan on your behalf also, to some degree, have fiduciary responsibilities. As your counsel, outside fiduciary counsel, I have fiduciary responsibilities to you. Your outside investment managers typically should be deemed to have fiduciary responsibilities to you, subject to the terms of your negotiated contracts. Certainly, in your investment consultant and your actuary, in my view, should have fiduciary responsibilities by contract at minimum to you. Who do not have fiduciary responsibilities? This is important as well because you interact with a lot of people and entities that don't have the same fiduciary responsibility that you do. The employer does not have a fiduciary responsibility to the members and beneficiaries. It's actually the other way. Employees have fiduciary responsibilities to their employer. The employer doesn't have fiduciary responsibilities to the employee. Your record keeper, your auditor, they don't have fiduciary responsibilities. Something I'll say in some of my other presentations I may have said to you before, people you interact with at conferences, at SACRs or CalIPRS, they don't have fiduciary responsibilities to your members. Nor do people who, others who you may hear from at those conferences. So just always keep that in mind when you're filtering information that you receive. Also recognize that not every decision made about CSERA is a fiduciary decision. And so this goes to the point I was making in response to Trustee Chabatara.
Took me a long time.
Dennis is fine.
I took 2 years of Russian, so I should be able to say this, but that was a long time ago. Some decisions are settlor decisions. Okay, so this comes from the common law of trust when you're distinguishing roles. And settlor is a synonym for trustor. It's the one who created the trust, who settled the trust. It's a little bit different in a public plan context and in the context of a plan such as a Searle plan where the settlor is really the legislature. And yet, because the Searle has to be adopted by a county to be effective, to be in effect, to be created, the county obviously also is the settler, and then there are optional provisions of CERL that they decide to adopt or not to adopt. Settler functions generally include the adoption, amendment, and termination of the plan. There is a little bit of overlap of functions in CERL because, as some of you, all of you may know, many of you may know, there are a few provisions of CERL that a retirement system board may adopt. But that's pretty rare. The reason why the provisions are subject to county or board of governing board of a district adoption is because of this understanding of settler versus administrator function. Officers of the plan sponsor may wear both hats. They might have both settler and fiduciary responsibilities. Certainly your ex officio member does. But we will talk about, and actually it's alluded to here on the third point, the fact that when a trustee who has different responsibilities depending upon their day job versus their CSERA job, they are to only wear their CSERA fiduciary hat when performing CSERA functions. This slide is to encapsulate decisions that are fiduciary or not. So examples of settler actions, with my little asterisks there, all actions need to comply with CERL, PEPR, and all other applicable laws. So in other words, when I say the settler determines the formula for benefits under the plan, they don't have unfettered discretion to determine what those formulas will be. They are limited to what's provided under CERL or PEPRA. Same thing with determining which employees will be covered by the plan. And that typically comes into play when you think about whether certain levels of, say, part-time people will be included as members of the plan or not. That's subject to regulations that are adopted by the retirement system and the Board of Supervisors. Decisions to offer matching contributions. Now, that's typically in a DC plan rather than DB, but because in a DB plan, they're responsible not only for normal costs, but also payments on the unfunded liability, and certainly decisions to terminate a plan. Now, recognizing there again that California case law has confirmed that once counties have adopted CERL plans, they may not withdraw. You know at CSERA that districts may withdraw in the sense that you have adopted policies over the years that provide terms and conditions for considering whether a district may withdraw. And that's all depends upon what you as the administrators, the board determines is permissible from a prudent standpoint in compliance with CERL. But the county cannot withdraw. Examples of fiduciary actions are in the second column, so the selection and monitoring of plan investments. So there may be a certain level, and often is for prudent fiduciaries, a certain level of delegation to the experts on your staff in consultation with your investment consultant about certain aspects of your investment portfolio, but you always retain the fiduciary responsibility to monitor and provide oversight. The selection and monitoring of plan service providers is a fiduciary function. Expending plan assets is a fiduciary function, and certainly the timely and accurate delivery of CSERA benefits. Deep breath. All right, any questions before we move into the do's and don'ts? No, okay. All right, well, there are lots of words on these slides, but I will walk through them because I find it's easier to sort of think about them as we express them verbally. So the first topic here is board member conduct on CSERA-related topics. And the do here is that board members should be asking your key point people. So that's your CEO, your CIO, your general counsel, depending upon what the question is, for analysis and monitoring information that's provided consistent with your fiduciary responsibilities. So for the exclusive purpose of fulfilling your fiduciary responsibility with respect to administering CSERA and the investment of the assets. So that's the monitoring and supervision role, analysis, asking questions, identifying red flags, et cetera. What you shouldn't be doing, and sometimes you hear about this in terms of discussions of policy boards, is that you shouldn't be individually directing the work of CICERA staff, certainly not based on priorities that you may have based on other roles that you have in either your day job or other personal priorities you may have, whether it's with a local group or a union or a retiree group, not to target any particular action, but each of you have or have had over the years, I'm sure, different responsibilities with the different agencies. And you're, when you're wearing your CICERA trustee hat, you're part of a unit, which is the board, and you need to be acting within the context of what this board's priorities are relating to CICERA. The second topic is board member communications with CICERA members and beneficiaries. This is another really important one because many of you, of course, know a lot of CICERA members and beneficiaries. That's part of the plan design here, that some of you are elected by active members, some of you are elected by retired members, and those of you who are appointed because you're an elector in the county and the Board of Supervisors has decided to appoint you. So you will necessarily know members of the plan, and they'll ask you questions about things. So that's the point of this topic, to address what you do in that context. And our view is you can communicate simple information if asked about a general benefits question from a member, very sort of high level, but most importantly, you refer the member to CICERA publications and other appropriate resources at CICERA where they can go. It's really not appropriate for either the members to have direct access, if you will, through a trustee whom they happen to know to special treatment. On the other hand, and most importantly, it is not appropriate for individuals on this board to be advising members about what benefits they are and are not entitled to. Because you have this all-important trustee hat and role and responsibility that you're supposed to be complying with. And if you give incorrect information, that can create real risks for the retirement system.
You remember Rich Cabral? He used to he was a trustee on the board.
Oh, I do.
Remember Rich.
So he used to put out a kind of brief newsletter on board activity and so forth. So he'd always preface it by saying, these are my feelings, not a statement from CICERA. So whenever we say things, we have to be careful to make sure that we are not speaking officially on behalf of CICERA, correct?
That is very true.
So he would just give a summary of what was going on and so forth, but you still have to be careful even in that context.
That's exactly right, Trustee McDonald. And a lot of times boards, codes of conduct will address for themselves, the board adopts a code saying what you may and may not do as a trustee in terms of speaking for the board or not speaking for the board, what type of disclaimer or caveat you need to include if you are going to say anything about a retirement system topic. So typically, those types of communications would be really important to also vet with your CEO prior to, even if you have that disclaimer, just so that there aren't any surprises and there isn't really inaccurate information being put out. Because people look at all of you as trustees of the board, as many times as you might say, well, now I have a different hat on. You have a level of authority and reliability, perceived reliability because of this role. Let's see, make sure I'm the right slide. I am. Yes. Okay. So the next topic is board compliance with the duty of loyalty as to the administration of CICERA. So this one relates to decisions that you might make on topics such as actuarial assumption setting and other administrative topics. that the do here is that you're doing so in consultation with your experts, so in this case, your actuary, with the perspective of taking action that is consistent with the overall best interests of your members and beneficiaries. The don't is taking more of a results-oriented approach to this topic. So, for example, if you're going into assumption setting with a goal of doing whatever you can to decrease the employer cost of the plan, potentially by increasing your assumed rate of return, by changing your mortality tables, or whatever it might be that results in lower cost, that's not consistent with your fiduciary responsibilities. What would be consistent with your fiduciary responsibilities would be understanding from your actuary what changes have occurred within your population and similar populations with respect to demographic assumptions, or what changes have occurred in the investment arena with respect to your economic assumptions and making changes based on that. So what I'm saying is not results oriented, but instead based on the building blocks that your actuary talks to you about that then lead to a prudent determination of what the appropriate assumptions are. The next one has to do with the investment of assets in terms of a duty of loyalty to what I mentioned before, which is maximizing risk-adjusted return. So your investment-related decisions need to be made in consultation with your CIO and your investment consultant with this aim of minimizing risk, maximizing return to the extent reasonably feasible within the context of your plan and within the context of the policy terms you've set forth in your investment policy statement, for example. Where fiduciaries can run into trouble is where there are other personal or political priorities that they might have that sort of make their way into the decision-making process that are furthering those interests potentially to the detriment of the plan. So that's what you need to be really mindful of. It's not that there's a set answer that is correct for all plans on these topics, but you have to be under, you have to, as fiduciaries, you should be considering the whys, the purpose, and making sure that the purpose that you are working towards is consistent with your fiduciary responsibilities to the members with respect to the security of their retirement benefits. The next topic relates more to how you interact with CICERA staff. And this is not something that is designed to address anything specific that I've been told about with respect to CICERA, just so you know. This is rather a topic that I see all over the state and country, for that matter, as one that that should be addressed in a fiduciary training. And that is that the do here is board members should be reaching out to their executive point people. Again, the CEO, the CIO, the general counsel, or if there's other management staff that has authority over a particular topic where it's appropriate for a trustee to be approaching them directly, those are the people with whom you're to interact. Even though you may know the staff quite well at CICERA, which is wonderful and have good relations, It's important from an institutional perspective that you as trustees not be directing their work and that it all go through the proper channels. Next topic, board member personal conduct. So here it relates to your board policies, and what we say is ask that you comply with not only the letter, but also the spirit of the policies. And where this becomes complicating is where trustees request exceptions to policies. Think, for example, of a travel policy, travel and education policy, and you have very specific parameters, perhaps, on what is and is not permitted. And the person who's the gatekeeper on that, who is the authorizer of expenses, is the very person who reports to your board, your CEO. But if individual trustees are asking for exceptions to the board's policy, it's putting the CEO in a very difficult position with one of her own bosses, if you will. So a better fiduciary approach is not to ask for exceptions for oneself. Next topic, the role of committee members. So similar to the board's engagement, the board's role, board members who sit on committees have the same responsibilities, and the way that committees are, from a governance perspective, are typically to work is to do even more of the hard work of the board so that your board meetings can run more smoothly or be a little bit higher level, and your committee does more of the work. And so this do is to engage actively in committees to which you've been assigned, come prepared to your meetings, provide input and oversight on topics within your committee's jurisdiction. The don't here is very similar to what I've been talking about all along, although there's an additional element to this particular don't, which is requesting particular consideration of special projects. If a trustee has a pet project that is really not a CICERA board priority, or even a CICERA committee priority, that isn't something that trustee should be asking staff to spend time on. The next topic relates to the role of chairs. So this is the board chair as well as committee chairs. From a fiduciary governance perspective, those positions are really important because that's the person to whom your staff should be turning and who should be communicating on behalf of the board or the chair with staff. Relating to the fulfilling of priorities of the board or the committee. The don't here is when committee and board chairs don't do the job that they're expected to do in those roles. So they either dominate, which is not what the chair should be doing. The chair should be making sure everyone's voice is heard, and then they're sort of funneling the majority view, or abdicating by not taking on that leadership responsibility, the role. Because the best functioning boards have really strong and wise chairs who can listen to their fellow board members, determine where there's consensus or at least majority, and then work effectively with staff on facilitating those objectives, and also being a sounding board for all of the things that happen between meetings or that need to be discussed in a different type of setting than an open meeting. So that's really, really important as well. Board training, such as this. Board members attend training even from Hawaii. appreciate the attendance. That are provided at your board and committee meetings, and then you choose relevant training opportunities to learn more about topics that are of importance as outlined in perhaps your education policy. It's also outlined in the CERL what the various education topics are that you're supposed to get your 24 hours of training in every 2 years. A don't here is to blow off the training, to not attend trainings that are provided to you by CICERA or that are provided at a more cost-effective way, such as the Zachers or CalIPERS trainings that are here in California, or even ones that are provided by national organizations such as NCPERS or others, but instead attend more expensive trainings that have minimal applicability to the prudent administration of CICERA. And that might be more applicable to somebody's other job. So that happens, and that's not consistent with fiduciary responsibility. The next topic here is how board members interact with the CEO and CIO actively and thoughtfully, rather than the alternative here, which is directing action where the authority has been properly delegated to the CEO or CIO. That I'll sometimes see in a context where there is a delegation by the board to staff, say in investments under a certain threshold. But the board chair or the investment committee chair is still trying to direct action individually. That's not consistent with the board delegation. board members, when they're asking questions, requesting analysis and monitoring information, are doing so for the purpose of fulfilling their fiduciary responsibilities. This is a little bit duplicative of some of the other things I've talked about here, but just you probably can't say it enough. The don't here is board members directing work based on priorities that they have in a capacity other than as a board member. This communication with members is also similar to what we talked about before in terms of, oh wait, did I go backwards? No? Well, maybe. All right, I'll just say it again. just don't communicate to people about, don't try to counsel people on their own benefits. All right, one hat rule. This is our final topic of the day. Thank you for your attention and engagement. The one hat rule is violated when people put a plan sponsor's interests or a union's interests or the individual trustee's interest or anyone else's interest ahead of the overall best interest of the plan participants and beneficiaries and the security of their authorized CSERA benefits. So really what this is a conflict of interest rule. It's illuminating that duty of loyalty, that single duty of loyalty that you have to your overall best interest of your members and beneficiaries, and identifying the fact that if what you have in your mind is this is actually in the best interest of me personally, or this is in the best interest of my union, or this is in the best interest of this other personal political priority that I have, or my employer, that could be a good sign that it's not, that you're not keeping your eye focused on the priority that you're supposed to have in this role as fiduciary. And on this slide, I cited the O'Neill case that I talked about earlier in response to Trustee Gordon's question. This should look like a familiar slide because I include it in most of my fiduciary trainings, if not all of them. But it's sort of an admonition at the end here that you should recognize as fiduciaries of CSERA and as fiduciaries of all other California public pension plans under the California Constitution, you have very broad authority and discretion in your decision making as to the administration of the plan and the investment of its assets. But that discretion is not absolute. It's certainly subject to judicial review, as we've discussed already. And the standard that courts typically will apply is to determine whether you've abused your discretion by acting in either an arbitrary, capricious, arbitrary way, so not supported by the evidence, capricious way, in a way that's motivated by something other than reason, or that is not supported by the information, the facts that are presented to you in considering a topic. And so process is important. I've heard fiduciary presentations before where the focus is only on process. I don't agree with that. Process is extremely important. The substance of your decision is also extremely important. So you're going to be overturned by a court in either event if your process is faulty or your substantive decision doesn't pass muster with the court. But one way to get to a decision where the court will uphold your exercise's discretion is to make sure that what that process does is it illustrates the connections between the facts that are presented to you and the decision-making that you engage in. Your education, this type of education, inquiry, disclosing the reasons for your decision-making, presuming that they are consistent with your fiduciary responsibility, also are important ways to have your decisions upheld upon challenge. Active independent actuarial oversight is really important. And that came up in the case I mentioned earlier about Alameda, that the Alameda County Employees Retirement Association, involving the actuarial assumptions that were, or actuarial methodologies used there. The actuary was very involved in that discussion and provided a lot of good recommendations to the board in connection with the discussions that and decisions that were later challenged. And that was important to the court. So active and having that present and visible is important. Independent investment oversight is also important. If your investment decisions were ever challenged to have your CIO and your investment consultant explain the rationale for their recommendations, to make recommendations to you upon which you can act, or at least to provide a range of recommended actions from which you can choose. All of that is really important. And then legal consultation and compliance with applicable law is also critical. I've put a fiduciary goal here that has a lot of words that I won't read to you, but I hope that it encapsulates in one sentence something that you can take away from this presentation, and then noting that you do have a code of fiduciary conduct and ethics that is provides an excellent framework for considering this topic and going back to it. It's on your website if you have questions, and you can always certainly reach out to your chief counsel and your CEO, and if they want to reach out to me, that's more than welcome if you have any specific questions. So with that, I'm finished, but I'm happy to take any questions you might have.
Thank you, Ashley. Are there any questions of Ashley?
Stunned you into silence?
Dazzled us, so we don't have any. You mentioned the process of decision making and providing a basis for that decision. I think one of the things that we've all experienced is the reaction to court decisions that are adverse to the decisions that we've made. Because to the credit of our board and our staff and counsel, when we make a decision, we provide detailed findings supporting that, right? We always marshal the evidence and to each of the required statutory factors, and we've exercised our judgment and we've made a decision based on that. And yet, as we all know, courts can still can and do disagree from time to time. So I feel we follow best practice in that regard. We have really solid decisions, but we have run into the inevitable conflict in court where a court or a panel or a judge will disagree with what we've done.
Yeah, and that happens. That certainly happens. The fact that a court disagrees with the way that you have exercised your judgment doesn't, in my view, necessarily mean that there was anything wrong about your process, but the court did disagree. So to the extent that there's any learning that can be gained from that, that's typically good. But again, without judgment about who was right or wrong, reasonable minds can differ. For sure.
Yes.
Yes. Those who have been around the block a few times know that.
Yep.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.